to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall never surrender.
Good day, everybody. This is UCY.TV. It's 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in the United States, 4 p.m. in the Netherlands, and 11 p.m. in Japan. Today I have a guest on. His website can be found at www.corbettreport.com. Corbett is an independent, listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, the central banking fraud, and more. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since then, he has written, recorded, and edited over 1,000 hours of audio and video media for the website, including a weekly podcast and several regular online video series. He produces video reports for GRTV, the video production arm of the Center for Research on Globalization, and BoilingFrogPost.com, the website of noted FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds. He is also an editor-writer for the International Forecast, the weekly e-newsletter created by the late analyst Bob Chapman. His work has been carried online by a wide variety of websites. His video productions are broadcast on the Next News Network in the United States, and his videos have garnered over 15 million views on YouTube alone. His satirical piece on the discrepancies of the official account of September 11th, 9/11, a conspiracy theory, was posted to the web on September 11, 2011, and has so far been viewed over 2 million times. Welcome, James.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for that very thorough introduction.
You're welcome. I'm honored to have you on. How did you get into this alternative media, James?
I really stumbled into this quite blindly. It was definitely not my intention to ever pursue this. In fact, I was an English literature major back in university, and whenever people asked me what I wanted to do with that degree, I would always tell them, I'm not sure, but I do not want to become a teacher, and I do not want to become a journalist. And fast forward 15 years, and I've actually worked in both fields now, so I guess that's the chains that us English majors bear. But really, this is a labor of love that came about through the discovery of the information that I started finding online in about 2006. And I won't go through the whole history of how that came to be, but basically I just started discovering some documentaries and information that I had never seen before through these new media of YouTube and Google Video and the video sharing sites that were around at that time. And it launched me into a completely different field of research than I'd ever been exposed to before. I had always had the sense there was more going on under the surface politically than we'd ever been exposed to, but it was really my experience watching those types of documentaries and then searching for the information online myself that led me to understand that there was something different going on. And from that understanding, I was just naturally led to try to impart this information to others. And from that kernel, all of a sudden, the flower of the website started to grow, and it was just such a spontaneous process, and it happened so quickly that really in the course of a few months, I had the idea, I realized the website, and I started the podcast, and I just never looked back, and that was 7 years ago now.
Yeah. Yeah, I was walking around like with these stars and birds flying around my head until 11 September 2001, when I saw these towers just disappear. And because I had an education in steel, I knew that there was something wrong. But I was still so naive that I thought, well, the American government is going to come with an explanation as to how these towers disappeared, right? But that never happened. So I started doing my own research like 6 months later or so, because the 9/11 Commission report was just a joke. And it led me kind of the same way into, you know, wanting to bring out all the information that I had discovered since then to the airways. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's a story that a lot of people in my audience can relate to, and myself personally, because, of course, 9/11 Truth was, I think, that gateway through which I started to discover this information as well. And once you start to see through the web of lies, it's really just a question of time before you start peeling back all of these layers of the onion that have been carefully constructed. And no matter how many years of conditioning we've been under, it is such a wonderful and freeing experience. It can be terrifying, it can be life-changing, it can be a lot of things, but I think in the end, it's quite a freeing experience to come to that realization of that we've been lied to and how we've been lied to. And I think in the end, I hope that is an empowering experience for people rather than an enfeebling one. And that's kind of what my media aims at.
Yeah, it was empowering for me. Just to know is powerful, so to speak. So, would you like me to get into the first question? Is that okay?
Yes, let's do it.
Yeah, so this is a topic that interests me very much. I think it has a lot to do with why we are in this mess we are in today. And so the first question is, what is social engineering?
Well, I guess the simple answer to that would be to say that social engineering is the process or the technique by which the social engineers can engineer society to respond to certain stimulus in predictable ways. And what I mean by that, perhaps the best way to get a handle on that definition is to turn to a definition of the word propaganda that was put out by Edward Bernays in 1928. In fact, he had an entire treatise in 1928 on the word propaganda. And for people who don't know, Edward Bernays was one of the pioneers of the public relations industry. And in 1928, he wrote this book, Propaganda, which began with a very memorable quote and one that I think is important for understanding this topic. He said, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country." And I think what he is gesturing to at that, and that's a pretty remarkable statement to put in black and white, and perhaps a testament to the fact that even back in the 1920s, the social engineers were confident that the average man or woman wouldn't be reading this. It would only be the sort of social engineering class that would be interested in reading a treatise like this. But I think what he's driving at there is the very important point that what we think of as mind control, although we have these ideas of in science fiction of some sort of, you know, a remote control device where you can basically puppeteer people like they're some sort of robot. Although I think those types of technologies actually are in the pipeline, so to speak. But I think mind control is more fruitfully understood as the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses. And it's so important to understand that to a large extent, the people who are trying to engineer society really do see us as very little more than automatons, as robots, and that we are just a collection of organized habits and opinions. And if we can be made to basically take on certain habits or opinions that these social engineers want, then we will then start to react in predictable ways. And this has all sorts of political ramifications, but I guess to try to keep this as concise as possible, social engineering is the process by which those organized habits and opinions are inculcated in a population.
So in his quote, he mentions that they are like the invisible hand. What was that again?
Yes, those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society, i.e. the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses, those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And that's such a startling and remarkable and an important statement to understand. Because again, we can have all of these layers of bureaucratic government over top of us, which we are all trained from a very early age to see as the ruling powers of a society, so that, for example, in the American context or the Dutch context or the Japanese context or the Canadian context, we are presented with this idea that we live in some form of representative democracy, whether that mm-hmm. be a parliamentary, a constitutional a monarchy or a constitutional republic, what have you. We tend to think of it as a representative democracy, where we vote in the people that will make that will help to form the rules of our society, etc. But the actual power in society does not rest with that ever-changing face of the governing structure. The real mm-hmm. governing structure is behind that, beside that, around that, over top of that, and consists of the people who are really. It consists of the people who are writing the checks for the social engineers who are using their techniques to condition the public. And I think that's the structure that we have to start looking at to understand the true nature of government and how it functions in our society.
Yeah, because it kind of raised the question for me is when it says the true ruling government, I was thinking that the banks are in control. How does that work?
Well, the people in control of the banks control the banks' money strings, which control the funding for the politicians, of course, but also, mm-hmm. of course, for the social engineers and the people who are in that process of manipulating the organized habits of society.
Yeah. So the Bank of International Settlements and the World Trade Organization, they all work together. Is that correct?
More or less. It was Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope who identified the Bank for International Settlements as being the central bank of central banks, which would uh-huh. be the mechanism through which the central bankers all around the world would be able to join forces and realize the far-reaching aim of capital, of international finance capital, which was to create an interlocking system of control over the finances of each country, which then, of course, create the conditions for the control over that country. And I don't think that really needs to be elaborated too much. Of course, if you have the power to create money, if you have the power over the money supply itself, then you are really in control of the most important commodity or feature imaginable in our modern day society. And mm-hmm. with that power, I mean, it's not money that is the important part of that. It's the power that comes from wielding the purse strings. And with that power, all sorts of manipulations can become feasible and possible and realizable. Things that to the average person, like yourself or myself or people around us that we know who are just struggling to make ends meet every month and make rent payments and things of that nature, it's almost inconceivable to imagine the type of power that people who literally have the power to influence the money supply itself have over the rest of us. And once we start to truly internalize and understand how effective that type of money can be, then we can start to understand the ways in which that is used to consciously manipulate our habits and opinions.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Edward Bernays. Is Aldous Huxley one of the people who is operating in this field of social engineering?
Aldous Huxley was certainly connected to the field of social engineering through his family connections and the milieu in which he was raised. I don't believe uh-huh. that he himself was a social engineer per se.
Okay.
I think he certainly had an effect on the culture through, of course, Brave New World, which is his best known work, but also mm-hmm. through his advocacy for psychedelic experience. In the 1950s and 60s, towards the end of his life, he became an advocate for psychedelic experience and was one of the people who was behind the flowering of the 1960s and the drug movement and all of that, which, of course, was also a CIA-sponsored counterculture, which was fostered into existence, I think, precisely for the purpose of manipulating the organized habits and opinions of the masses. So I think uh-huh. he certainly had connections and inroads and insights into that group. And to a certain extent, I guess you could say he was a social engineer of a type, because he did have some importance as a well-recognized writer. Although I don't think he saw himself necessarily that way. I think he more saw himself as someone who was observing this phenomenon and commenting on this phenomenon, which he did so quite explicitly in not only in his works like Brave New World, but also in some of the speeches that he gave. And I always point back to one that he gave towards the very end of his life in 1962, just the year before he died. He gave a speech at Berkeley in which he basically outlined the remarkable progress that was being made at that time towards the scientific control of people in that type of mind control, that sci-fi mind control type situation that I talked about earlier, where we were talking about, you know, a remote control to move people around as if they were robots. He was actually talking about experiments of, for example, electrodes being implanted in people's brains that could make they could deliver shocks that would make people feel certain sensations, feel certain emotions, etc. And he was quite, you could tell he was evidently, immensely interested, we'll say, in those types of technologies and their political implications. And he spelt it out quite clearly, I think, by saying that obviously the dictators of the future are going to delight in making people actually to desire their own servitude. Which it seems so ridiculous when it's presented to someone without any context, but when you start to see the ways that that not only drugs or electrodes in the brain or other such technologies can produce those effects, but by the ways that propaganda itself can produce the effect of making people actually desiring their own servitude, it's quite an amazing phenomenon, and one that Huxley was definitely involved in documenting.
When you mentioned that Huxley was also promoting drugs, is that a way of setting up a controlled opposition?
I think that had something to do with it. I think that there's also there was certainly an attempt to detach the counterculture, which I think was understood would develop around the anti-Vietnam War movement, to spin it into politically ineffective fields, so that it became it became more about dropping out and turning on, tuning in, and all of that. The Timothy Leary catchphrase, rather than actually engaging with the system in a meaningful way. And so I think there was an attempt to undermine that, but it was spread even before the Vietnam War officially started. Of course, the Vietnam War had been ongoing as more of an intelligence operation since the 1950s. But even before the actual real military operations began in earnest, I think that the CIA was already actively involved with this. And the CIA's involvement with LSD had already developed through their MKUltra experiments into trying to find truth serums that they could use to deliver to the enemy, or mind control substances that they could use to create a Manchurian candidate. So, for example, you know, capturing an enemy and making him do your bidding would be, you know, a dream of any intelligence agency. So they were actively at work on that and using such things as LSD as possibilities for that. They found it was not very effective at all as a truth serum or as a way of controlling people to that extent, but it was certainly a good way of getting people basically shunted off into completely different areas of experience that didn't affect them politically. And I think that they jumped on that bandwagon as a way of trying to divert what was going on. And there were a lot of organizations that were behind this, not only the CIA, but the Esalen Institute and others that deserve looking into. But I think that was the 1960s counterculture, to a large extent, was pioneered and pushed in certain directions by the U.S. intelligence apparatus.
The Esalen Institute you mentioned, that seems, I took a look on their website, and they seem to me a kind of a new age organization. Is that correct?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that these subjects all swirl together to a certain extent. And when you put in the sort of meditation and yoga and psychedelic experience and all of these things, which I think really did coalesce and really come together in the 1960s counterculture movement, I think it becomes more of a holistic lifestyle, which in that sense is meant to quite obviously, I think, change the habits and opinions of those who undergo those. I mean, it's quite an overt attempt to do so. And of course, this was an institution that was founded by Michael Murphy and Dick Price in Big Sur, California in 1962. But their goal was explicitly working towards what Aldous Huxley called the human potentialities, trying to realize the human potentiality. So again, Huxley was quite essential in the creation of this institute.
Yeah, yeah. Is television a tool used to social engineer?
Television absolutely is. I would say that there are three main branches of social engineering that we can look at in our society. Oh. And maybe there are more, but I would identify education, PR and advertising, and media as the three main methods through which this manipulation of our habits and opinions are perpetrated. And when it comes to media, there was the catchphrase by the Canadian philosopher of the 20th century, whose name is going to escape me at the moment, but he's very famous. He came up with the phrase, "The medium is the message." And if we take that to heart, we have to question, what is the message of a medium like television? And I would say if we go back further in time, of course, we had the development of the written word, which, of course, was back in the sands of time somewhere in pre-recorded history. But we had the development of the printing press, specifically in Europe in the 15th century, which was really the beginning of a modern civilization with literacy as being a widespread phenomenon rather than just something held by a very small, rarefied, educated class. So I think the medium of writing taught the people that mediation itself was necessary for understanding experience. Before the printing press and before the popularization, for example, of the Bible in translations that people could actually read for themselves, of course, people would go to these masses in Latin that most people didn't speak, and they didn't understand what was being said or what was happening. They only understood the actual biblical stories that they were being taught to believe in through mostly through the pictures and paintings and the visual depictions of those things. That was the way that these people related to it. And that, of course, relates to sort of natural human experience. Humans kind of left to their own devices, discover about the world through their own sensory experience. But when we are introduced to this thing, no, actually, the in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Logos is God, and it is contained in this Holy Bible. And you can't read it, but trust me, this is what it says. That experience teaches us not to trust our own sensory experience. It teaches us that we must somehow receive reality through mediation. So that's an important step towards the society that we're at today. I think television brought that further by teaching us that we are viewers to be programmed. Literally, television programming occurs, and it is these shows are programmed by programmers who are sitting in offices in New York City or wherever these corporate headquarters may be, basically deciding who will watch what and when, and what the standards of what will be allowed or not allowed will be, etc. So basically, in the era of television, people became these passive receptacles for information, and it more so than what that teaches us in terms of what news or whatever people actually got from the television. It teaches them to be passive observers of reality. It once again puts the people back in the idea of looking to their sensory experience. It's a very visual medium, so it's immediately comprehensible in that way, but it teaches people that they are just these detached eyeballs, basically. They are the camera is their eyeball, and they just watch reality as it unfolds on a screen. And I think that that's such an important and fundamental part of the psychology of the 20th century that I think that when historians of a future age write about the 20th century, I think they will have to take into account how much simply the medium of television and what it taught people about their role in society actually contributed to the events of the 20th century and the kind of detachment from political engagement that we saw over the course of the 20th century. And then if you want to extend that into our current age, if we want to look at media that are newer, of course we can talk about virtual reality experiences, gaming experiences, other things that are sort of superseding television and in many ways becoming more popular with the younger generations. But yeah. And in some ways, this might be seen as hopeful because these are more interactive experiences. So again, it's putting people in their sensory experience and teaching them how to interact with their environment around them rather than be passive receptacles. Yeah. So there's positivity in that. But I think that the medium of gaming is really teaching people how to be rats in a Skinner box. And for people who don't know about Skinner, B.F. Skinner was a Harvard psychologist from the mid-20th century, and he's best known for his work in behaviorism. Basically, he comes from this tradition I guess you could go back to Darwin and sort of the implications of evolutionary theory and sort of the removal of the supernatural element from humanity leaves humanity, of course, simply as another animal in the sort of the order of the world, but also it sort of removes any contemplation of humanity as something an end in itself. It becomes merely a means to an end, which is the way that the behaviorists really saw humans, such as Skinner. He wrote actually a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, I believe was the name of that book, in which he argues that freedom and dignity should not and do not apply to human beings, because really what we are is basically blank slates, almost like robots to be programmed. And this developed from the work that he did in operant conditioning, which is just a fancy way for saying that he taught, in most of his experiments, it was pigeons, but he also worked with rats and certain other animals. But basically he would put these animals into situations where he could either reinforce what they were learning through positive reinforcement, or he could deliver painful shocks or something to adversely affect their behavior. And through this, he was able to get these animals to perform certain tasks or to respond to certain stimulus in certain predictable ways. So that, for example, he could train a pigeon to do a complete counterclockwise turn three times or something, whatever sort of mechanical thing that he wanted them to do. He could eventually train them to do it by simply reinforcing their behavior with food pellets or adversely affecting their behavior with electrical shocks or what have you. So he would develop these boxes where he would put these operant conditioning boxes. They're called Skinner boxes in modern parlance. And this is how these pigeons or rats or these other animals were trained to do these tasks. And in the exact same way, the behaviorists and Skinner and others see humans as basically these rats and pigeons, just to be trained to react and act and react in certain predictable ways. And if they can be done, if they can be programmed to do so in an orderly fashion, then we could envision the creation of this total system of control that would be perfectly happy. Everyone would be happy because they would all be responding in the ways that they know how, in the ways they've been trained, and they could basically just be acting as robots, functioning in a perfectly harmonious society, rather than these crazy individual irrational beings just going around the pool table like billiard balls. So that's, I think, the vision that we're being led into by this new media of gaming. And if people want to really understand what I mean by that, there's a very interesting YouTube video out there called "The Most Disturbing Presentation Ever: Our Tech Nightmare." And for once, this is a really hyperbolic title that lives up to its name. It's this presentation by this person at a technology conference talking about the various ways that games are being incorporated into all sorts of different phenomena, including advertising and things, to get people to willingly interact and willingly do certain things that they would not be so interested in doing. And he starts talking about, well, we could extend this into an imaginary future where it wouldn't be hard to imagine, for example, if the government wants to get people to brush their teeth three times a day every day, they could start a point system so that in your toothbrush there could be a sensor that detects when you're brushing your teeth. If it's activated three times a day, you might win 5 points, and it's structured like a game, and if you get to 100 points you level up and blah blah blah. And he goes through this in such a future that we could very easily imagine, and at the same time it's very chilling with all of the implications about human nature itself that it brings, and the ways that we can be manipulated into being willing participants in whatever system the social engineers want to put us in.
Yeah. Do you have a little bit of history of mind control and how DARPA plays into this?
I don't have a concise history of DARPA's experiments and how they play into this, but I do know that human beings have been, throughout history, the most studied species on the planet. And even when we study other species, like chimpanzees or rats or pigeons, it's generally, what are the implications for humanity? So I think when we look through the history of experimentation in the social sciences, almost anything that you look at is going to be in one form or another trying to better understand how humans act and how they react to various phenomena. And in that context, it's difficult to imagine. I mean, there are not many experiments that in some way do not play into this in a certain way. Specifically, how this relates to mind control and what people kind of think of as mind control. I mean, there are some very amazing experiments that have been conducted, and I'm not sure to the extent that DARPA was involved or who was involved, but I know that there are experiments, for example, in which electrodes have been wired into rats and cockroaches, and I believe I actually saw the video of the cockroach experiment, where they could literally be made to move in various directions. They could be made to move left or right or forward or backward by researchers with that type of remote control device. And
they do that with bulls as well.
Yes, exactly right. Yes, there was an experiment I remember. I believe it was mentioned. I'm sure I've put it on my podcast before, but yes, there was an experiment where an experimenter got literally into the bullfighting ring with a bull that had been outfitted with such an electrode in his brain, and the researcher had the button which he could press to send a shock into a certain part of the bull's brain that would immediately alleviate its aggression. So the bull could be in mid-charge, charging at the experimenter, and he would press the button and it would stop, basically stop moving towards him and just wander away. And I believe there is video of this that I've seen before. It's quite a remarkable phenomenon. And again, I mean, as amazing as that is in terms of what's happening in the animal world, how much more chilling is it to think of that type of technology being used in the human world? And how much more chilling than just that type of rote mechanical type of technology is the idea that in some sense, we're moving towards a world in which human beings can be fashioned from the bottom up. We can be fashioned from our gene, our genetic structure. And the more that that technology develops, the more these types of mind control technologies and implants in people's brains, etc., will be irrelevant at some point in the future if this technology progresses towards the genetic side of it, because we can literally be engineered to be like the replicants in Blade Runner, these sort of superhumans that can do anything and work in very adverse conditions, but we could be programmed, for example, to die off after 5 years of productivity or whatever it is to keep us in line. And that is kind of the ultimate realization of the social engineers. If people want to know what's really behind this and what the real plan is, I think it is that vision of a completely controlled society to the point where there not only is no rebellion against the wishes of the social engineers, but there's no possibility of rebellion, that people are so completely controlled, whether it be through complete mind control or through genetic control or what have you, that there's really no possibility that there will ever be an uprising. And at that point, I think the social engineers, the elite class that believe themselves to be worthy of ruling over humanity, will be able to basically keep however many they decide, 100 million, 500 million, 50,000, whatever it is, of these sort of chattel slave replicant cyborgs, whatever they decide to end up with, as the people who actually do the physical manual labor for society. And I think that's the vision of society that these people have, which again sounds like crazy science fiction fantasy until you start actually reading a lot of these foundational texts that these people work from.
Yeah. I have a question from the chat. I have no clue about what he's talking about. He says Skinner was born in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, to William and Grace Skinner. Grace Skinner. Is there a hidden connection to the Susquehanna Hat Company? Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of Susquehanna. I don't know the Hat Company, so okay. I'll have to read up on that. I don't know.
Okay, I'm sorry, Dan. We couldn't answer your question. Another question I wrote down is, And this reminds me of John Taylor Gatto, because you mentioned education also in the ways that we are social engineered. How do we defend ourselves against it?
Well, the answer to that is so simple that it has in fact been known and talked about for centuries, but it is so simple that most people actually tend to defy the answer because they think it is too simple. The answer, for example, we could go back to the 16th century French philosopher Etienne de la Boetie, who wrote a famous essay, Discourse on Voluntary Servitude. He wrote that in 1548, and it's widely available online. People can go look it up. And he really provided, I think, what is the ultimate answer to that? How do we defend ourselves against this? What is the answer to this? He said, "What is the fundamental political question is, why do people obey a government? And the answer is that they tend to enslave themselves to let themselves be governed by tyrants. Freedom from servitude comes not from violent action, but from the refusal to serve. Tyrants fall when the people withdraw their support." So those words were written 500 years ago, and I think are as absolutely applicable now as they were back then. The technologies for control of the population have changed, and at a certain point, I suppose, there will no longer be the possibility to do what's being suggested here, but at least for the time being, we still are capable of conscious thought. We are still capable of rising above the propaganda, recognizing it for what it is, and choosing not to go along with it. And it is that choice. It is that choice itself which is actually the way out of this. And I know, again, that's not a very satisfying answer for people, because a lot of people have been programmed, I think, through their cultural conditioning and the media conditioning to believe that there is some sort of savior that will come, or some sort of Rambo, yeah. Or we'll have some sort of big fight. There will be some war, and, you know, the bad guys will line up and good guys will line up and we'll shoot each other until the good guys win. Something like that. That's the way we've been conditioned to imagine how this will ultimately end. But it does not. The true act of winning in all of this is simply to maintain our consciousness as human beings and to refuse to go along with the propaganda. And it is simply a choice that we make. And I would say, for example, I mean, we either choose to be free human beings or we choose to live in servitude. And that really is a state of mind. And if you were a free human being, uh-huh. there may be people in jackboots with guns who come along to throw you in a cage. But all they've done is thrown a free human being in a cage. And that's a travesty. And it goes against the natural order of things. And other free human beings who see that and recognize that travesty will act accordingly against that travesty. And seek to right that injustice, but the fundamental fact that person is a free human being in his mind has not changed. And I think that's ultimately what this is all about. I think one of the most important psychologists of the 20th century wasn't a psychologist at all. It was an author, George Orwell, Eric Blair, who of course wrote 1984. And what was the ultimate message of 1984, it really was that consciousness, just the act of Winston keeping his diary, for example, was uh-huh. humanity winning. As long as there was humanity able to speak, to think consciously for themselves and to go against and defy and remember the past as it truly was and to stand as testament to that, that is humanity's victory. And at the end, the defeat comes from him ultimately being brainwashed by the system and learning to love Big Brother. That is the defeat. He's lost the ability to think and feel and react as a human being. So really, I mean, it's a remarkably simple thing. For people who are already listening to this conversation, chances are you are probably already among the conscious, among the living, among the people who see through the fabric of propaganda that they're putting around you. And that is your victory, and you have to hold on to that, because everything that they do ultimately is aimed at trying to detach you from that, to try to put you back under the spell of the Matrix and to just go along to get along. And so if we recognize that, then really the power is ours to simply withdraw our support from the system and achieve our victory.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, Dan was pulling my leg about the Susquehanna Hat Company.
I thought so.
Yeah, he's a tendency to mess with me, and sometimes he succeeds. So, James, Your website is jamescorbett.com, is that correct?
No, corbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com.
Yes, of course. C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, guys, check it out. It's a very nice site, I've checked it out, looks real professional. There's all kinds of tags there, like 9/11 activism, economy, false flag, Fukushima. How are you doing, buddy? Are you in any danger?
Well, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And I guess not only are the people in Japan in danger, I would say that people all around, certainly the Northern Hemisphere, are in a type of danger, but the question is how much danger? And that's really the operative question. And I think people should be looking into this for themselves and looking at the evidence that's out there. But ultimately, the people who have researched this know that there is no safe level of radiation. So any amount of radiation that's being leaked into the environment is a travesty and needs to be corrected. However, I'm not on the side of the people who believe that this is sort of the Earth-ending event. I know there are people in the alternative media who want to blame sort of anything that happens health-wise on Fukushima. I think that a lot of that has been overplayed. So FukushimaUpdate.com is my Fukushima website, looking at the latest news that's coming out of there. And basically, we're trying to keep track of all of the news as it develops so that people can get sort of just the basic information. I'm not trying to sway anyone's mind as to the ultimate meaning of all of this, but I just want people to know the information about what's happening at the site and what the latest readings are and what people are saying about it.
Yeah. You have also a YouTube?
Yes, I do. YouTube.com/CorbettReport, and I try to put up 3 or 4 videos a week. Lately, it's been more like 2 or 3, but at any rate, updated on a frequent basis.
What do you discuss usually on that YouTube?
I have a number of different series that I do. For example, I have a weekly news update series called New World Next Week. I do that with James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we basically just talk about and dissect 3 different news stories and sort of dissect the propaganda and take a look at what's really behind it. I also do a monthly series with Brock West of APPerspective.net, talking about the Asia-Pacific region that we're in and some of the political and military developments that are going on here. I do a monthly series with David Smith of the Geneva Business Insider, where we talk about finance and economy and geopolitical issues. I do a lot of, I do a weekly eye-opener report for BoilingFrogsPost.com, which is basically a 10 or 15 minute investigative video piece on all sorts of different subjects. In fact, the last one was one trying to debunk the old myth that World War II ended the Great Depression. And that is, in fact, not the case for anyone who actually bothers to look into it. But again, that's just part of the conditioning that we've received since our earliest time. We've all heard it since we were school children, so we all tend to just believe it. Oh, the Great Depression ended because of World War II. And in fact, the economic data doesn't support that. But that's not something you're ever likely to learn in your 15,000 hours of enforced education during the schooling system.
The problem with World War II here in the Netherlands is that ever since that ended, people think they are free, and that kind of settled it all down, and nobody's speaking up anymore about the things that are going on, restricting all of our freedoms.
There is no one more enslaved than people who believe that they are free, falsely believe that they are free. There is no one more ignorant than those who falsely believe they have knowledge. So I think that those are 2 of the most effective ways that people are kept in that state of obedience and dependence on the state, is simply to be told all our lives that you don't have to look into this. You already know about it. You don't have to fight for your rights. You already have them all. You're already living in paradise, basically, is the message of the system, the overwhelming message that we're force-fed from the time we're children. So I think, once again, the most effective thing that can be done is simply to counter that, to reflect on the fact that that's not the case, to point out the ways in which we are not free human beings, to point out the things that we do not know, And we could relate that back to both of our 9/11 experiences. Both of us, at some point, believed we knew what needed to be known about 9/11. Oh, the government will take care of it. They'll provide an explanation.
Yeah.
We were both very, very wrong about that. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. again, in our own personal lives, I'm sure you've seen it. I know I've seen it, where there are people that you talk to about these issues that don't even want to listen to any facts that you can present to them because they already know what happened and you're just crazy for thinking otherwise. So again, it's a very insidious system that works on a lot of different levels to keep people in that state of ignorance, perpetual ignorance.
Yeah, I've had that problem also when I was speaking to my nephew about this event. And I asked him, well, how many seconds did it take for the World Trade Centers to disappear? And he looked at me with these eyes that said, well, what are you talking about? And so I made him go look at the video that was available. And he just couldn't believe it. And he said, I don't want to know about this. You know, this is upsetting my worldview, you know. And so it kind of turned into a fight, really. And that's really bad when that happens.
It is unfortunate. But perhaps there's a seed of hope in there, because I don't think that most people are swayed just on one presentation of facts at one moment. Most people have to have that kind of seed planted in their consciousness that will ultimately flower in time, and only if they are actually bringing themselves into that. Rather than, I mean, people can be told facts until they're blue in the face, but generally people will only start to really understand and internalize those facts once they take it on board and start looking for more information themselves. So you never know when you encounter someone like that and it devolves into some sort of fight. You never know how that will be processed in the future. And who knows, a year, 10 years, whatever it is down the road, they may actually come to the sort of understanding. But it takes time to break down those mental barriers, because again, I mean, those are some of the most important parts of our identity is wrapped up with this conditioning and programming that we've received from our earliest childhood. So so it doesn't fall very easily, but when it does, it can be quite an amazing experience.
Yeah, these mental barriers also make it that you or I or Jan Irvin or whoever cannot wake up other people. They have to do it themselves. They need to go and do their own research and let the cognitive dissonance show them where they need to do more research and find out what's really going on.
Yeah.
I saw when I finished kind of my 9/11 research, which took about 3 years, I was pointed by somebody to this documentary that's called Century of the Self. There were also others he mentioned, like The Trap, and there's also another one, which I don't remember now. Unfortunately, when I tried to look them up on the YouTube a couple of weeks ago, they have been censored by the BBC. They say, well, it's infringement of copyrights and you can't watch this anymore. But I thought that was a very good video by Adam Curtis. Could you tell a little bit about that?
Yes, in fact, Century of the Self was one of the early documentaries that I was watching during my sort of waking up experience in late 2006, and it was one that had a very important effect on me. Specifically, the first part of that, it was a three-part series. I thought the second and third part kind of drifted. The narrative became less sure. But the first part was fascinating and looked at, for example, Edward Bernays, who I mentioned earlier. And again, for people who don't know, he was one of the kind of pioneers of the public relations industry. And he used he was actually the American nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he used psychoanalysis as a way of trying to better understand the underlying subconscious drives and motivations of people and tailoring advertising and PR campaigns to that subconscious drive. So, for example, back in 1929, he was contracted by George Hill of the American Tobacco Company to break the taboo against women smoking, because the American Tobacco Company looked at this and thought, well, we have half the population that, because of a social stigma, won't touch our product. Why don't we just break that social stigma and we'll have, you know, we'll double our market. And so they contracted Bernays to do so. And he actually engaged several psychoanalysts to try to get to the idea of what is smoking? What does it mean to the psyche, especially of the American female. And they found it was most strongly associated with the idea of masculine power. And I think we all understand that's why a lot of the advertising back when cigarette advertising was allowed was you know, these rugged cowboy types or what have you.
Yeah.
Always that kind of image. It's the masculine power of the cigarette. And so he decided to tie it into the suffragette campaign, which had just won the 19th Amendment in the United States to allow women to vote that passed in 1920. So it was still a very new phenomenon, sort of having women politically engaged. So he decided to set up this PR event during the New York Easter Day parade, where he would hire a bunch of, you know, good looking models to be part of that parade route, and to stop at a prearranged place and pull out their cigarettes and call them, you know, their torches of freedom, and light them up as a protest of man's inhumanity to women. And he let some newspaper and photographers and insiders know about this and where this was going to be taking place, so that they could be ready with their cameras. It all worked beautifully. They plastered this over the front page of all sorts of different newspapers. Here's these beautiful women with their torches of freedom, proclaiming their, you know, freedom from mankind and what have you. And it worked so well that that basically within days, similar protests started taking place in Denver and San Francisco and Boston and other places which Bernays didn't have anything to do with. These were actual spontaneous protests that involved these torches of freedom, these cigarettes. So within 6 weeks, the League of Theaters in New York actually lifted their ban on women smoking in their smoking rooms. And the rest is history. Obviously, that taboo was thoroughly broken. So that's the kind of exceptional power that people like Bernays wielded. And I forget where we started with this. I forget why I brought that up.
Because of the Adam Curtis.
Adam Curtis, yes. So that was one of the aspects that he looked at in the first part of Century of the Self, was Edward Bernays and these incredible advertising and PR campaigns that he engaged in. And that was so important for me for understanding how social engineering works and the effects that it can have. Because once you start to internalize stories like that, and then start to look at the types of stories that were fed on a daily basis with the news. I mean, even recent stories like the saving of Jessica Lynch and things like this that we now know were literally orchestrated phenomenon that involved Hollywood directors and all of these things. I mean, they were orchestrated PR campaigns. So we can see this in even being enacted in our own society. So it was a very, very interesting documentary from that perspective. And Adam Curtis also did The Power of Nightmares, another extremely important documentary where he looked at the roots of Al-Qaeda and the roots of the neocons, and kind of tried to create a parallel narrative of those two groups. Again, a lot of interesting information in there, including basically how Al-Qaeda as some sort of group was constructed in a New York courtroom, basically for the purposes of prosecuting Osama bin Laden. They had to try to make it into an identifiable group, so they could say Osama bin Laden was the group leader, and then they could use RICO laws, basically anti-mafia laws, to say this is acting like a mafia, so we can prosecute Osama bin Laden for anything the mafia does. So basically the idea that Al-Qaeda is some sort of centralized, is some sort of group that actually, you know, coheres with a structure and, you know, leader and all of this, was constructed in a New York courtroom. It really didn't exist until it was sort of conjured into existence. And that was an important part that was well explained in that documentary. But the problem that I have with Adam Curtis, again, in every documentary he does, there's generally something that's worth understanding there. He brings up some very interesting parts of the past and you know, fascinating information. I get a lot of good information from there. But it's the way that he develops his narrative that is always profoundly unsatisfying. It's always profoundly establishment supporting in a way. For example, when he takes on the neocons and how, you know, they're just like Al-Qaeda because they're religious ideologues too. Basically, he takes them at face value, that these are basically, you know, Christians who are motivated by an attempt. They really want to bring democracy to the Middle East. I mean, there's nothing happening underneath the surface of an Adam Curtis documentary. Everyone is taken at face value, and it promotes promotes the sort of 9/11. Yes, it was done by 19 men with box cutters and just goes completely mainline establishment in that regard. So I find Adam Curtis to be, in some ways, the most insidious kind of propaganda, because it has those good elements that make you think, wow, this is really good and important. But it also, at the same time, hooks you into a mainline establishment supporting narrative.
Yeah, you also mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald as being the assassin of John F. Kennedy. So yes. I'm like, huh?
Yes, exactly.
So that made me kind of look with an eye that is like, this Adam Curtis, I would like to ask him some questions.
Absolutely.
Hey, but people are posting some of your stuff in the chat room. It says here, interview anti-Illuminati from CorbettReport.com. What is that about?
Yes, back in, I believe it was 2010, 2011, somewhere in that time frame, I was interviewing someone who was posting on the Prison Planet forum. At that time, there was forum.prisonplanet.com. One of the main posters in there was someone who went by the pseudonym of Anti-Illuminati, and he posted a lot of information about about Booz Allen Hamilton and companies like this that are part of sort of the information industrial complex, and how they their technologies and their strategies, etc., inform and infest the U.S. military, and how they're applied in society generally, and how computer technology is used to try to control the population, etc. So we had a series of interviews back at that time. Although at this point, I have no idea if he's still out there, if he still posts. I really don't know anymore. But we did have a few conversations that were well received by the audience back then.
Awesome. All right. We're almost out of time, James.
Time flies.
Yeah, it really did. It's like it seemed like half an hour. Is there anything you want to mention?
Well,
End this?
Well, again, I'd just like to bring it back to that positive message that we can take away from this. And again, it's nothing new and it's nothing really profound. I think it's something that we all already know. But basically, the message is that the system relies on our voluntary participation, and it functions very well with that participation. And it functions very poorly if we start to withdraw that participation. And it's sometimes difficult to get our head around how do we actually start withdrawing from the system, because, as I say, most of us are struggling to pay the rent every month, and we have to, you know, go to our 9-to-5 job or what have you to try to make ends meet. And then we come home and we don't want to do anything else, so we veg out in front of the TV. I mean, it can be a very easy trap to fall into. And so how do we start withdrawing ourselves from that? And I would just like to ask the audience to find the ways, the points in their own life that they feel are most most vulnerable, I suppose, to being changed, whether that is something as seemingly insignificant as choosing to go to the farmer's market every weekend instead of going to the supermarket on the weekend, or whatever it is that we can do to change our habits and opinions to try to go against the prevailing orthodoxy. Because again, if all of this billions of dollars and all of this time and engineering and psychological research is going on specifically to influence your habits and opinions, then your habits and opinions must be immensely valuable things. And if you consciously choose to take those and to direct them in conscious ways towards things that you want to support, local communities and communities of interest, people who are interested in freedom, people who are interested in helping other people rather than, you know, trying to make a quick buck off of people. If we direct our energies towards that, if we start to organize our lives around those habits and opinions that foster those types of communities, we truly can overcome this problem. And in some ways, that's a very simple thing to say, and it's a very difficult thing to do. And I realize that. So I think we have to be realistic about that and take it in baby steps. But ultimately, that is the answer. So I'll direct people once again to Etienne de la Boetie. They can go read Discourse on Voluntary Servitude, and we can start.
Could you spell that?
Etienne de la Boetie. So Etienne, E-T-I-E-N-N-E, de la, D-E-L-A, Boetie, B-O-E-T-I-E, a French philosopher from the 16th century. So definitely worth reading.
All right, James. Thanks very much for coming on the Solvinor event.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on and talking about this important and oft-neglected subject. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Awesome. Thank you. Take care, buddy.
Thank you.
Well, that was James, guys. What did you think? I think it was awesome.